Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. What a disastrous, stressful, difficult, very awful week this was. We will start by speaking with Marge Baker. She's an executive vice president of People for the American Way. They are a kind of counterpoint to the Federalist Society. They try to nominate fair-minded judges, non-judicial activists. And then we're going to go back to the archives from a 2014 interview I did with Johns Hopkins political scientist Stephen Tellis, the author of the great book, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, to kind of put it all in perspective and see how we got here. First, a few thoughts on, again, what was a crazy week. Among the things that stood out to me about Brett Kavanaugh's testimony during his hearing to get to the bottom of Christine Blasey Ford's allegations that he'd assaulted her when she was 15 was his unbridled partisan animosity towards the committee's Democratic senators, especially the women, and of course what mainstream outlets refer to as his repeated dissembling, his lies. And the thing that I kept thinking about it was this interview that I did back in April. He was on this show. Brian Schaffner is a political scientist at UMass Amherst, and he published one of those studies that kind of demonstrates empirically something that everyone had already known intuitively. He found that Donald Trump's bigoted rants about Mexicans sending us their rapists made white people more likely to express their own racism out loud. Schaffner did this experiment. He divided white respondents into different groups. He showed one group a series of campaign messages that included Trump's infamous rant, Mexican rapist rant. He offered a control group a series of kind of less inflammatory campaign lines from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And then he asked everyone some open-ended questions about their opinions of various groups, African-Americans, Latinos, other groups. And he found that the group that heard about those bad Mexican hombres expressed significantly more hostile, more bigoted opinions about all of the out-groups in the survey. So, if you'll recall, regular listeners may remember this, Schaffner told me, and I'll quote, "There have been several psychological studies showing that people tend to take cues from their peers when they're asked to talk about other groups. When they hear somebody saying something offensive about some group, then they basically say to themselves, oh, I can say that because this other person said it, so it must be okay." He said that he thought that something similar was happening with this because people were hearing a politician who is running for president with one of our major parties using this kind of inflammatory language. And they think, well, if this major party presidential candidate can use this language, then it must be okay for me. So Schaffner told me, and again, I quote, "I think people are changing their understanding about what the norms allow for or preclude based on what they're hearing from Trump." So, you know, you step back a bit and you look at this Brett Kavanaugh performance. It was classically Trumpian. Trumpian has blown up the norms that would have dictated to a Supreme Court nominee in the past to put on an air of fairness, to put on an air of good judicial temperament during the confirmation hearing. And he blew that up. He blew it off. He said, you know, he came out fighting. He talked back, especially again to the women on the committee. And he, you know, it strikes me that this guy was a member of Washington's elite, right? I mean, he was the prep school boy. He screeched, "I got into Yale without any connections," during the hearing, and he just went kind of full Limbaugh loving frat boy on national TV, in addition to lying through his teeth during a confirmation hearing, which, by the way, is a felony. And, you know, it just strikes me that we probably are seeing this toxic, the same dynamic that Brian Schaffner described about white voters may very well be infecting the conservative political elite in this country. I thought about this again when I was considering Senator Lindsey Graham's repeated outbursts. He all but called the accusers, Kavanaugh's accusers liars. He kind of artfully massaged it, but he basically called them a bunch of lying whores. He went on a number of tirades, just very aggressive tirades. He said it was all a conspiracy, similar to Donald Trump's deep state conspiracy theories. And, you know, it's striking again because Graham has always portrayed himself with this sort of aw shucks mannerism. He was close to John McCain with that mavericky thing. He's always portrayed himself as bipartisan, as a moderate, if you will. He was a leader in the gang of whatever immigration reform efforts. And here he is going full Trump. And I wonder if they're ever going to be able to put the toothpaste back in the tube, right? Jennifer Rubin had an interesting column this week. Jennifer Rubin, the former wingnut who has, I think, been really affected by the rise of Donald Trump. And I think it's called into question a lot of her beliefs. She wrote that everything we're seeing is really anathema to the conservatism that she understands. And it's a different brand of conservatism than what we understand. Those of us on the left understand when we look at conservatism. But she was talking about how her view of conservatism put a high priority on civility, factual adherence to the facts, not engaging in personal attack. Now, again, this is not the conservatism that you and I have come to know, but I think that it's entirely possible that Donald Trump has toxified conservative elites in a way that we don't fully appreciate and that may be permanent. He very well may have created a permanent shift in the discourse in the right. And a lot of people think that a few electoral thrubbings will break the fever of Trumpism. And I'm not sure if that's true. I think Trump may well have signaled that the norms have changed for a lot of conservatives in the same way that he did for white voters with expressions of racial animosity. This may well be a permanent feature of American politics, the crassness, the dishonesty, the hyper partisanship. And on that sunny note, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back and speak with Marge Baker. Stay tuned.
Here comes the sisters with the stuff. Bring it home to bake it, grind it up in the pan. fountains of laughter, spitting out rapture. I'm not the one to go after. In fact, the attitude is cheerful. Come on and get an earful. We do it all. Holder never stalls, y'all. No, Spinderella takes care of a bit. Salt and pepper, definitely in this to win this. We bring home the bacon and make crazy Luigi. Don't mistake me for a hoe. Hell no, I'm not a Fiji. Here I come. Remain true sisters of the game. Blowing suckers out the frame, pow. Hard work paying off, baby Paul. You know who we are going for. On his head, coup de grace. Eeny, meeny, miny, behind me, the loser. Caught up for a sec, but got wrecked by the bruiser. Didn't know who's the real tag team here. The 1, 2, 3 days, now it's all clear. Yeah, we pump, pump, storm, romp. Open up a preschool to babysit the competition. Listen, the mission I'm dissing. The rest of premonition, so no switching position. I make the bacon so crispy. No need to get pissed, the man. I does it all, kid, I'm bad. So don't let your pride eat your inside out. Independent blacks are back. It's always about them and them females with the floating no phone. Go ahead, tattoo attack. Black, you can't do with nothing. Cause I, here we come. Here we come.
Welcome back to the show. This is still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Marge Baker. Marge is the Executive Vice President at People for the American Way. Just full disclosure, I used to be a Young People for Fellow years ago, and they offered me some trainings. I went to Washington, D.C. Actually, I met Andrew Gillum, who is running for governor of Florida. He was the program coordinator at the time. Anyway, Marge Baker, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you so much for having me, and I did not know your Young People 4 background. That's wonderful.
Yes, I used to be a YP4. I was part of the inaugural class.
Oh, wow. Oh, the first class. That's fantastic.
Yeah, 2005, I believe it was.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember we went to, we had this whole thing at this hotel, I actually heckled my friend Mike Tomasky when he spoke at the end.
I love it.
He deserved it. Marge, let me ask you this just on a personal basis. How exhausting was this week?
You know, this was a gut-wrenching week. It was really, really, really tough. I mean, the stakes are enormous. The bravery of Dr. Ford coming forward and just sort of that, you could see the agony of what she's been through and how difficult it was and how courageous she was being in coming forward because she felt that it was her civic duty. And then, frankly, it was frightening to watch Brett Kavanaugh's testimony. I mean, there was serious reservations about his temperament and the anger and the degree to which he was willing to attack Democratic senators, in particular Amy Klobuchar. It was all very, very upsetting, frankly.
You know, it strikes me when you talk about his temperament. I keep recalling that he had spent hours at the White House prepping through mock hearings. They had run him through the paces. It's striking to me that this was not a spontaneous outburst of emotion. This was the plan going in, that he would be nakedly partisan, hostile, loud, boisterous, et cetera, et cetera. It seems so far from the kind of judicial performance that one would expect. I think that he probably would have been better served, I believe this, if he had gone in and kind of portrayed himself as an aggrieved, decent guy who might be able to call balls and strikes, as they say, impartially. And he came away as this really, as like a, like we're going to put Rush Limbaugh on the Supreme Court. It was really striking to me.
I think that's right. I mean, his reaction was very Trumpian, frankly, and it was, I think part of it was absolutely calculated. He understood that he needed to come in, frankly, to satisfy, I believe, his audience of one, Donald Trump, that he was going to be aggressive. But there was also an element of lack of control. When he went on the attack to senators who were cornering him, for example, when he went on the attack on Senator Klobuchar about blacking out from too much drinking, I don't think that was planned. I think that was a lack of control, and that's, frankly, what really troubled me about his temperament, in addition to the high super partisan nature. But he went in, that was planned, and the idea that he would think that was okay is troubling. But some of it seemed to me just a lack of control.
It also seemed to me, the New York Times did a fact check, I believe they published it yesterday or this morning, and they found just a significant number of false statements, and some of them were very obvious, you know, when he was trying to portray the kind of teenage boy sleazy things that they'd put in their yearbooks as entirely benign, when we all know what those things meant, right? I don't want to get into all the details,
yes,
of the Renate alum and
right,
whatnot, but it seemed to me that these were such easily disprovable falsehoods. And it was striking to me because, you know, we're not interviewing this guy to be the manager at the Hilton Hotel down the street. This is a person who is trying to get a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land, and he made demonstrable falsehoods. Shouldn't that be disqualifying beyond what you think about the sexual assault allegations, beyond everything else, beyond his partisanship and judicial temperament or lack thereof? How serious is it for a Supreme Court nominee to offer a series of falsehoods during his confirmation hearings?
It's very, very troubling. And what we saw Thursday was a pattern. It didn't just happen on Thursday. It happened in the first hearing, where he lied and misstated any number of things, including his involvement in the purloined emails from the Senate Judiciary Committee back when he was in the White House counsel's office. These were emails stolen by Republican Judiciary Committee staffer from Democratic staff. A huge amount of stolen emails that he trafficked in. And he was clearly misleading the committee about his involvement in that, clearly is misleading the committee about past statements he'd made about his involvement in issues around electronic surveillance when he was at the White House, or issues around the nominations of several very, very controversial judicial nominees that when he was in the White House he was trying to get through. So this was part of a pattern of lying, misleading, evading, not answering questions, obviously not wanting to answer questions. So what we saw on Thursday was very consistent, excuse me, with what we've seen before. Well, excuse me. And it's very troubling. It's very troubling. I mean, our view is that what we knew going into Thursday's hearings is that if this was a job interview, he failed his job interview on
right,
issues around sort of the character and integrity and trustworthiness to hold this position. And then what we saw on Thursday was really, really, really serious issues about his temperament.
Yeah. I want to go back briefly to the kind of emotional toll that this week took, because I am not a victim of Survivor. I am not a woman. And it was emotionally racking for me. And then there was this outpouring, and perhaps in the long run, it will prove to be cathartic, but there was this outpouring of horrific stories of abuse coming from women across America. And it appears, and I want to be cautious about this, it appears that this very, very emotional reckoning had some role in Senator Jeff Flake's decision, after announcing that he was going to support Kavanaugh's nomination. On his way to do that vote, in the elevator, he was confronted by two women who screamed at him that he was sending a message that people who assaulted women would be protected by other men and elevated to positions of power. I just want to get your sense on this emotional aspect of it, this profound kind of sense of a grievance. And do you think that that is something that penetrated Jeff Flake's mind right. somehow?
You know, I would frame it slightly differently, which is that this week you saw women, and in particular you saw survivors, asserting their own power. They were taking back their power and insisting that they be listened to. And I think that absolutely penetrated. And what I think was most telling from that confrontation, the survivor's confrontation of Flake in the elevator, is the survivor who said, "Look at me. Don't look down. Look at me." And she's asserting her power to be heard. And that's what was so profoundly moving to me. I myself am not a survivor, I am thankful for that. But you could see people who are saying, "I am not putting up with this. I am not going to take this abuse. I am not going to be take being kind of disrespected. I have power in this room. I have power in this world. I have power in these halls of Congress, and I'm going to assert that." And it was incredibly moving. And that's what, and you saw that in the hearing room, frankly, with, you know, women senators on the Democratic side who were just fed up with being put down, and the notion that somebody who's trying to convince them that he should get this most incredibly important promotion to the highest court in the land would have the audacity to challenge them personally. It was horrific. It was just horrific.
It was. The reason that I wanted to be cautious with giving Jeff Flake too much credit for being swayed by real people is that he is well known for having a certain fealty to institutional norms that are lacking from, say, Mitch McConnell.
Right.
He obviously cares about the Senate. He obviously cares about the Supreme Court. And I don't know to what degree, you know, he was swayed by the appeals of not just those women. He said that he had been inundated with phone calls and emails, et cetera, and from people he knew. But he also expressed real discomfort with the process itself. I wonder about the legitimacy of the court if this nomination goes through. We've seen Merrick Garland not even being given a hearing. That seat was held open. That is Antonin Scalia's old seat was held open for almost an entire year of Barack Obama's presidency. We saw Neil Gorsuch, who is extremely right wing, given that seat. And now we're going through this debacle. I can almost see a point coming where blue states say, you know what, it's a Republican Supreme Court. They maintain their majority by hook or by crook, by any means necessary. And I don't know that we need to respect their rulings. I don't know that I have necessarily a really clear question, but I've been thinking about John Roberts, who famously is concerned about the esteem of the court among the public. How much damage do you think that this would do if it was jammed through in terms of public opinion of the court? And let me also ask you this. There is this counter argument that says, look, basically people shouldn't view the court as an impartial, nonpartisan body because it doesn't function that way. And it hasn't certainly for many years. Maybe it's better to get this out in the open and raise public awareness of how craven some of these decisions have been in terms of gutting the Voting Rights Act, Citizens United, et cetera, your view?
So I actually think probably both things are important. So let me see if I can track this. I mean, first of all, I think there are real concerns about the institution of the court, frankly, the institution of the Senate. Patrick Leahy was very, very, very strong on that. I've never seen him more animated in a committee session. He was just animated about the threats to the institution. So I have been known in my circle to be the optimist of sort of seeing the positive side of things, glasses half full. And I think it is possible that what we saw on what we saw yesterday was a moment to stop. The institution of the Senate is being ultimately totally threatened if they try to ram through this nomination without further investigation. It cannot happen. And that what you saw among Jeff Flake and his good friend on the other side of the aisle, Chris Coons and others, was stop. For the sake of this institution and for the sake of the Supreme Court, we need to do this better. We cannot do this the way we're doing. We cannot power through. We cannot stay on Mitch McConnell's, you know, push it through at all costs, you know, drive this through approach. And so if this is a potential turning point, it would be phenomenal. Obviously don't want to assume that. But I think what you did see on Thursday was or Friday was both needing to sort of respect for hearing survivors' story and treating them with respect and the dignity they deserve and the seriousness they deserve, as well as a real concern about where the institution of the Senate was headed and what that might mean for the Supreme Court. And I do think, I do think there was a sense of, yes, ideology matters, and as to your second point, it's really important for people to understand, and I think frankly, progressive community is getting in the way they haven't before, how critical the Supreme Court is to any number of the issues, the ones that you mentioned, just a huge host of issues, and understanding that the goal here has been to put a partisan, somebody on the court with a partisan agenda who's going to drive that agenda. And that needs to be of serious concern. But I think there is also, and this is why I keep coming back to the temperament issue, there's a question of, yes, we understand that ideology matters and understand that, you know, it is a fact that Democratic and Republican presidents will nominate someone closer to their view, political view. But that what you have in Brett Kavanaugh is somebody who just does not have the temperament to sit on the court. So in addition to driving a political agenda, you have somebody who just doesn't have the temperament to do that. And so I think those things are coming to a head. And you know, it's hard to say, you know, exactly where it's gonna come out. But I do think the awakening that we're seeing among progressive activists, and it's been powerful, more powerful than any nomination campaign I've been involved in before, is good. It's good because people understand that it absolutely matters who sits on the court. And frankly, it's why it absolutely matters who wins elections.
So you found a silver lining here. I'm impressed by that, given how awful this week was. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Marge Baker from PFAW. Marge, I asked you for 15 minutes. I'm at 16. Do you have a few more minutes?
I do, yes.
Or do you need
I
to
do.
Run? Okay. So we have taken this pause for a week. The FBI will reopen its background check in a limited way, limited scope and time. Can you give us a sense of actually how this will work? And are they going to be able to do what they need to do to vet this candidate in this amount of time?
So that is a good question. And I think a week is, it would have been better to have more time, but what we understand that they will do during this period of time is they will not just interview Dr. Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh about Dr. Ford's allegations. They will also be looking at the allegations of Deborah Ramirez and Julie Swetnick, two other survivors who have raised serious allegations about sexual abuse by Brett Kavanaugh. And then in addition, we understand that they will interview others who may have knowledge of what went on. So they'll try to do sort of interviews to validate some of the circumstantially whether the allegations that are being made or the defense by Brett Kavanaugh have credibility, you know, have are reasonable. And they will not reach a conclusion one way or the other, but they will present a deeper set of facts that enable us to evaluate or enable the Senate to evaluate put in context the allegations and evaluate the sort of truthfulness or accuracy of what both the survivors and what Brett Kavanaugh are saying.
Now, I know that you're not a former FBI agent or anything
Correct.
Like that, so I know that your knowledge of this is from your position as a legal expert at PFAW, but I wonder if And let me know if you're not aware of the answer, but the falsehoods or false statements that he made, some of them were directly relevant to this claim. Will they be investigating the accuracy of those statements? And at some point, does that expose him to criminal liability? It is a felony to lie to Congress.
Right.
In theory, it's very rarely punished, but it is a crime.
Yeah, and it's a good question. I don't know for sure, but my common sense tells me that to the extent they're evaluating sort of the allegations about the sexual assault and the circumstances surrounding that and the statements that are made about that, I would assume that they have to get into the truthfulness and accuracy of what everybody's saying. And yes, since these statements have been made under oath, and again, the FBI will be interviewing, and it is a crime to lie to the FBI, there is accountability if you've lied. So, I mean, I think again, this is just my sort of common sense understanding of this, not having personally been involved in these kinds of investigations before. Yeah.
So let's say hypothetically that during the next week, excuse me, journalists, certainly Democrats, partisans, are going to spend a lot of time focusing on the falsehoods that Brett Kavanaugh has told. I believe that's the case. It is entirely possible that other allegations will come up, although the FBI is not empowered to investigate new allegations. They could surface in the media. So let's say hypothetically that we get to a point where, let's say, Murkowski and Collins just can't do it, and this nomination goes down. I think it's fair to say that it is imperiled. Do you know what happens next? I mean, the White House has said that they don't have a plan B, but they do have a short list of other candidates that they've presumably vetted and considered before choosing Kavanaugh.
Right. So I mean, assuming that the nomination is withdrawn at some point, and it's ultimately up to the White House, hypothetically, assuming that happens, there's kind of three things that could happen. One, the White House could just wait and not do anything until after the midterms, I think probably unlikely. The White House could actually engage in serious bipartisan consultation, go off of the list, which is incredibly controversial, and find someone. There are a lot of, you know, well-qualified conservative jurists who are not on this list that the administration could put forward. So you could have, you know, a serious bipartisan consultation, go off the list, you know, pick someone who, you know, many Democrats would likely oppose, but would at least have been the product of a consultation process and somebody who likely would get through. And that could happen, you know, so that process could be set in motion. And the third thing would be that the president would just go back to the list, nominate someone who's also unacceptable from progressives' point of view in terms of ideology and in terms of where they're going to move the court, and threatens, you know, Roe v. Wade and the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and we are kind of back to where we were in terms of, you know, a much more contentious nominations process. If that were to happen, I think Mitch McConnell would desperately try to get it done by the end of the year, because concerned about whether the Democrats would take over the Senate, and I don't know. I doubt he would be able to get it done in that amount of time.
Yeah, and I think Amy Barrett would be after Brett Kavanaugh. My guess would be that Amy Barrett, just because by virtue of being a very conservative woman, would probably be the smart pick.
Well, they might go there, but I do have to say that Brett Kavanaugh's record was disturbing and is disturbing in terms of his hostility toward Roe v. Wade and the likelihood that he would vote to overturn the constitutionality of the ACA. Barrett's record is actually even stronger on that than Kavanaugh's.
Ugh. And there's that would be just a party line thing. So you don't think that he could get it done by the end of the year?
I think it'd be hard.
Interesting. Okay, well, this has been an extremely stressful week, and I want to thank you so much for helping us put it all into perspective and figure out where we are. Folks, you know, stay active on this. It's important to stay in touch with your senators. Keep doing what you're doing. One lesson from this week is that you need to always fight. You can't give up before the battle is over. And I think that that was something that we all learned. There was so much there was so much resignation among progressives as recently as last week that this was certainly going to happen. You know, it was a done deal. There was nothing that we could do. And we saw that that was not true. Marge Baker, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
What you are doing is allowing someone who actually violated a woman to sit in the Supreme Court. This is not tolerable. You have children in your family. Think about them. I have two children. I cannot imagine that for the next 50 years, they will have to have someone in the Supreme Court who has been accused of violating a young girl. What are you doing, sir?
I was sexually assaulted and nobody believed me. I didn't tell anyone, and you're telling all women that they don't matter, that they should just stay quiet, because if they tell you what happened to them, you're going to ignore them. That's what happened to me, and that's what you're telling all women in America, that they don't matter. They should just keep it to themselves, because if they have told the truth, you're just going to help that man to power anyway. That's what you're telling all of these women. That's what you're telling me right now. Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter. That what happened to me doesn't matter. And that you're going to let people who do these things into power. That's what you're telling me when you vote for him. Don't look away from me. Look at me and tell me that it doesn't matter what happened to me.
Brother, call a girl a bitch or a hoe. Trying to make a sister feel low. You know all of that got to go. Now everybody knows there's exceptions to this rule. I don't be getting mad when we playing, it's cool. But don't you be calling me out my name. I bring rap to those who disrespect me like a dame. That's why I'm talking. One day I was walking down a block. I had my cutoff shorts on, right? Cause it was crazy hot. I walked past these dudes when they passed me. One of them felt my booty, he was nasty. Yeah. I turned around red, somebody was catching the rat. Then the little one said,
yeah, me, bitch.
And laughed. Since he was with his boys, he tried to break the fly. I punched him dead in his eyes.
Who you calling a bitch?
U-N-I-T-Y.
Days at work give you an attitude and you abrupt. It take it out on me, but that's about enough. You put your hands on me again, I put your ass in handcuffs. I guess I fell so deep in love, I grew dependency. I was too blind to see just how it was affecting me. All that I knew is you was all the man I had. And I was scared to let you go, even though you treated me bad. But I don't wanna see my kids see me getting beat down by daddy smacking mommy all around. You say I'm nothing without you, but I'm nothing with you. A man's don't really love you if he hits you. Yeah. This is my notice of the tool. I'm not taking it no more. I'm not your personal whore. That's not what I'm here for. Ain't nothing good gon' come to you till you do right by me. Brother, you ain't
who
sitting
you calling
in the
bitch.
You and I.
Now that you saw Apache's video, I saw you wildin', acting like a fool. I peeped you out the window, jumping girls after school. But where did all of this come from? A minute ago,
of people out there with triggers ready to pull it while you trying to jump in front of the bullet. Young lady, and real bad girls are the silent type. Yeah. Ain't none of this worth getting your face sliced, cause that's what happened to your homegirl, right? Walking with nobody. She got to wear that for life. Who you calling a bitch?
Welcome back. This is Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm, you know, I like to put things into a larger context. So I'm going back to the archives. This is an interview that I did with Stephen Tellis. He's a political scientist at Johns Hopkins, and he is the author of The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, The Battle for Control of the Law. We did this interview back in 2014. It's especially relevant today. It kind of gets into the very long game that the right has played to shift the court, make it more partisan, make it another branch of government that it can control. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the story you tell in this book really begins in the 1970s, and it's about a well-funded, long-term effort to kind of shift the ideological center of gravity in our legal profession, in law schools and legal conferences and journals, and ultimately in the courts themselves, to the right. This was happening as the conservative movement was also investing in intellectual infrastructure in other spheres. You know, they were investing in think tanks and advocacy organizations and their own media. First, let me ask you this. What was it about our judiciary our judicial culture at that time that the right felt needed to be changed?
So I think it's important that you switch from the judiciary to judicial culture. In the book, I established that in a way, conservatism there was reacting as much to the law schools as it was reacting to what was going on directly in the courts. In a way, the story starts even earlier, back in the late 50s and the 60s, when the law school, the legal profession, the ABA, all these organizations, very elite organizations, throw themselves in with a kind of liberalism. And law school faculties become much more liberal. The ABA starts supporting legal rights of all kinds. And this sort of control of the legal profession in the legal culture that you described is really the thing that I think conservatives are reacting against, just as much as they're reacting against what's going on in the courts. And so I think it's really important to get both of those in mind. And it's also important to distinguish between what I think of as the elite reaction and the popular reaction, right? So there's a popular reaction to, going back to decisions about church-state that helps mobilize the Christian right. I think that's an important part of the story. And then it's really the things I write about in the book, things like federal society, law and economics, some of the conservative public interest law, that's really more reacting against this change in the elite legal culture, that in a way was supportive of what was going on in the courts, but I think is sort of distinct from it. So I think the first thing it's important to distinguish is there's a popular kind of legal mobilization against legal liberalism, and then there's an elite mobilization, and the elite mobilization is really the one that I'm talking about in the book.
And give us a scope of how they approached it, a sense of the amount of the kind of institutions that they created to support this movement. How much did they really invest in this project?
Yeah, so again, in the book I bend over to be fair. And I think in bending over to be fair, it's really important to recognize that as much as conservatives were investing in some of these things, They were investing because there had been a parallel investment on the left, right? This mobilization didn't come out of nowhere, right? So the Ford Foundation had put enormous amount of money into, and some other liberal foundations had put enormous amounts of money into changing law schools, into investing in legal clinics, which allowed people to do something kind of like legal activism in law schools. They'd invested in public interest law firms, a lot of the ones that we know and love today, the Environmental Defense Fund, in our, you know, National Resources Defense Council, the organizations of Hispanics and women in law, right? And so there had been an enormous liberal investment, as well as sort of capturing those institutions that were there already. So, you know, there were tens of millions of dollars that were invested by conservatives. But it's important to recognize that those were trying to mobilize against something that had happened on the left, and that, that had been a quite substantial investment on its own, right? So again, lots of money is put into law and economics, which was an effort to try and find a kind of foothold in the law schools on the faculty. This is one of the only areas that wasn't sort of defended, a lot of these areas of private law. The Federalist Society gets created, which is an effort to kind of create a parallel curriculum in the law schools, because conservatives found it so hard to actually directly change the composition of the law school. So their strategy was to bring their own faculty in to give talks and give lectures to the students. And then there was an investment in public interest law firms. You know, some of the ones that you probably people might have heard of were the Institute for Justice, which was behind cases like Kelo, which was about property rights, defense of school choice. And the Center for Individual Rights, which brought a lot of the anti-affirmative action litigation. So there was a broad attempt to mobilize against organized legal liberalism on all of these fronts.
Stephen, the if you look at the conservatives on this Supreme Court, they're obviously extremely activist. We've had probably a dozen legal scholars on the show, and also journalists like Dahlia Lithwick and Ian Millhiser. And they've all talked about various 5-4 rulings. And we've heard again and again that the court is making decisions that would have been difficult to imagine not so long ago. There have been a couple of studies that found that conservative justices are more likely to overturn both acts of Congress and regulatory rules than their moderate and liberal counterparts. Let me ask you this. When you see this, I guess it flies in contrast to what a lot of people would think about judicial conservatism, you know, that it would have something to do with respecting past precedent, showing judicial restraint. Do you think that that's born of this sense that the books had been cooked by, you know, the Ford Foundation, et cetera, that they were reacting to the capture of our, were they kind of trained to be revolutionaries?
Well, in a way, I kind of think this is slightly a bum rap, right? In the following sense, right? I mean, first of all, conservatives arguably were very activist going back to the early 20th century and the late 19th century. So this is the court that we associate with Lochner.
Right.
And then it was liberals who actually were the ones who arguably were the inventors of the idea of judicial restraint, right? People like Felix Frankfurter. In fact, the whole New Deal was characterized by an argument for judicial restraint that to a substantial degree got overturned in the 50s to the 70s in the Warren Court. And in a way, the era of judicial restraint that we think of as being sort of, you know, starting in the 60s and 70s on the right, is in a way originally conservatives taking up the Frankfurtian, you know, liberal arguments at the time in which liberals had started abandoning them, right? And so it's not surprising that in a period where liberals are starting to be activists, conservatives are arguing for judicial restraint. Then conservatives kind of consolidate their power starting in the 80s and 90s, and it's not that surprising that they then start becoming activists in their use of the courts, and liberals start suddenly discovering judicial restraint, which none of them had been particularly sympathetic to back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So the more political scientist of me, right, thinks of this as sort of a predictable feature of what ascendant political movements do, right? Ascendant political movements generally are in favor of judicial activism as soon as they've consolidated their power over the courts. And people who are have lost control of the courts generally become advocates of judicial restraint because they're saying, hey, you, who's in charge of the courts, stop doing stuff. So, you know, I think you can still criticize the court, but it's not somehow unprecedented in American history, and it's not like liberals didn't do something similar when they had equal amounts of control over the courts.
You're so fair. I do think about Citizens United and them sending the litigants back to come up with a First Amendment argument. And it was Stevens in his dissent. He wrote like five justices weren't happy with the case before us, so they changed the case to give themselves an opportunity to change the law. Let me ask you this. What is law and economics, or the law and economics movement, I guess you'd call it, and what does that look like when it gets into American courtrooms? How does it manifest itself in the real world?
So again, I mean, if you think about law and economics, originally, right, the area that it was most directly applied to was antitrust, right? That's if you go back and look at Richard Posner, who we associate as one of the early founders of law and economics. They were really talking originally about antitrust, and part of the reason they were talking about antitrust was this was an area where the courts had admitted that you had to do basic economic analysis, and they had been more or less ignoring the body of standard, at least in this case, Chicago kind of microeconomics, which was arguing that antitrust cases needed to be decided on the basis of what was good for consumers. And there was a non-trivial amount of liberal support for that. Originally, law and economics then sort of expands to other areas, to property cases, all kinds of range of cases to apply what originally is fairly standard conservative Chicago economics, but analyzing legal issues. And now there's a kind of liberal law and economics too, right? A lot of your listeners may have heard of behavioral economics. Gradually now, behavioral economics is starting to seep into law and economics. But I think originally, conservatives saw this as something they needed to get behind because it was the one area of law, all those areas of constitutional law were sort of very well protected by liberals, right? They didn't want to let anybody who questioned the authority, the orthodoxy in. But in a lot of areas of private law, of contracts, torts, of the areas like that, those are kind of less defended, and those are the areas where conservatives were able to get the largest number of people who were sympathizers with them into law schools. And I think that's still true. If you look at most law school faculties, you go to almost any of them, it's almost certainly the case that it's usually only the law and economics scholars often working in private law areas who are conservative, right? And the constitutional law scholars and civil rights and all those are almost all still liberal. So I think that's a case where conservatives certainly were successful. That's partially because they made an enormous investment in creating these Olin law and economic centers all over the country. But it's also the fact that liberals weren't defending that territory like they were defending a lot of other territory.
Now, you mentioned the Olin Foundation. I think it was 2005 or 2006. This is the John M. Olin Foundation, which it was a big investor in the conservative legal movement. It funded, of course, the Federalist Society, but it endowed a bunch of academic chairs. They invested in conservative media, the whole works. Anyway, in 2005, they folded their tent and they said, we kind of, you know, mission accomplished. We did what we set out to do. To what degree have they been successful? Dahlia Lithwick says conservative legal institutions are, you know, ascendant. They're like the only game in town. Is that right? Is that where we're at?
No. I love Dahlia, but I don't think that's quite right. I mean, it is true that Olin folded up its tent. Now, it didn't fold up its tent because it thought it was so successful that it didn't need to keep doing it. Now, Mr. Olin, in his infinite wisdom, had decided that he didn't trust his kids or anybody else, and he had seen what he thought, unfortunately, it happened to the Ford Foundation. His perception was that the Ford Foundation started out as being conservative, and then got captured by liberals. And so he sort of said, that's not going to happen to me. I'm going to make William Simon, who had been the Secretary of Treasury under Nixon, I'm going to put him in charge of the foundation. And then after he dies, you know, in not too long, we're going to fold the thing up because they can't trust anybody else to run it. And, you know, they did do a very impressive rate. And I think part of the reason they were so successful is they knew they only had so much time. There was a kind of urgency in their work, and along with a kind of long-term orientation. And I think, you know, they were very successful in helping to reorient the political conversation. And I think the most important thing is, again, in legal culture, and to distinguish this from the courts, right? In legal culture now, conservative arguments aren't exotic, right? People have heard of them, right? Liberals show up to Federalist Society events. And I think this is one thing that people often misunderstand about the Federalist Society, right? They think of it as a kind of bonding exercise for conservatives to get together and gripe about liberals. And I think there is that element. But the Federalist Society has always had a kind of evangelical quality, right? There's always been a perception that they could, and they wanted liberals at their events. They wanted to try and, you know, if not persuade people, at least make them think that that was within the range of legitimate conversation. And I think in that sense, they have been successful, right? Even lots of liberals who've gone to law school and consider themselves very liberal, right? They've heard some of these ideas before, and they don't treat them as simply shocking or things they have to, you know, they can just dismiss. They think of them as arguments they have to argue with. And I think that, you know, over long periods of time, that does, you know, shift the range of ideas that things like courts can do, right? Because they're ideas that are within the very broad range of things that people think are not, as Jack Balkin said, off the wall. And I think in contrast, I think liberals have not been very good at that kind of investment. Liberals have been much more oriented toward short-term investments. They want metrics and measurement to show how things are paying off in 2 or 3 years. But if you really want to shift the ideas that people think of as not crazy, right, not necessarily the ideas that people agree with, but the ideas they think of as at least plausible, right, that's the work of decades. And that's the kind of thing that Olin was willing to do. And I think, you know, when you see, you know, how aggressive this court has often been willing to go, that's partially because, you know, it's staffed by clerks who've been to law schools, you know, like Harvard and Yale and Stanford, where they have strong Federalist Society chapters, and they've gotten steeped in these ideas, and they get onto the courts, and they're, you know, they're providing these ideas to the justices. They're helping to write the cases. And I think, you know, liberals have not been good at that kind of work. And I think if they want to change some of these things, that's the kind of really long-term investment they have to be willing to put their money into.
That was my interview with Stephen Tellis from way back in 2014. He wrote the book in 2009, so 4 years before Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, still telling. I want to thank Steve for doing that interview so many years ago, but I really want to thank Marge Baker for helping us sort out a very frustrating, very emotionally racking week. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or wherever else you get your sound, your podcasts. You can send an email griping the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd also like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Misogynistic rapper. It was probably ugly as a kid, hella chubby. Only girl he ever took to prom was his cousin. Now they acting bitter and they writing in a song like they've been waking up with two women all along. I'm the next supreme, I'm the next supreme. Word to the queen by any mean, murder scene. Pussy kill, I'm a savage with a spit. A cultist with a killer ammunition in the clip.